Bonjour,
ni hao,
comment estas? This is John James, and welcome to Champagne Strategy. This is a red pill business podcast which deconstructs world-class strategy, focusing on growth, marketing, and sales with just a sprinkling of tech and champagne. Listen to this episode if you dare, but you've been warned, there's no going back. If you do any work in the world of advertising or media, especially in Australia or the UK, you should have heard of Karen Nelson Field. Such is the prominence of her brand. Fresh from a recent escapade on the French Riviera, we're talking with Karen today, but not about attention or advertising management. Besides, that's been covered already at length. Her name and business has been rocketing up the business charts recently, so I was really curious to find out more about her story. After all, she was a former academic and researcher at the Ehringberg Bass Institute, but she's moved on from that world to a large extent. Why? What motivated her to strike out on her own and start Amplified Intelligence? Why attention management? And how has she crafted her personal brand over the years, and where is she heading in the future? And I really want to ask her how different it is learning theory and laws in isolation versus actually implementing them in a business and crafting a product offering from scratch. Unlike some industry commentators out there who commentate and criticize from the sidelines, she's actually put her money where her mouth is. And I really want to talk to her about categories. Product categories, market categories, category creation. Do categories even exist anyway? And how bound are we by categories? Can we stretch, distort, or even move outside, or again, create our own altogether? And along the way, you'll hear her entrepreneurial story, which hasn't been covered in much detail ever before. So in this conversation, you'll go behind the scenes, behind what you probably know about her, and we find a different side, a deep business intellect which many haven't explored before. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Karen Nelson Field. Let's open our bottles. But hey, thanks for coming on the show, Karen.
That's okay. My pleasure. Wait, I haven't opened a champagne bottle for a very long time.
Yeah, well, while you're doing that, there is a really cool place in Adelaide called East End Cellars, and they're an independent wine purveyor and retailer. And I've had some really good wines there. It's very well class. Anyway, so I got this from them, and they import this one exclusively. So I don't think many other stores, if any, in Australia would sell this champagne.
So funny story, I used to work for Diageo in my 20s, and I knew that they were a good purveyor of wine and all things spirits. So do you want to start
opening
them?
I'm going to open one now.
Okay, you ready?
That was good. Yeah, that's happened before.
There we go.
I'm going to pour a glass as well. So this is actually, what is it? Mikkel Genet, is it?
Yes,
I think.
It is.
Well,
that's
cheers.
About as much as I know. Cheers to you.
Okay, I'll tell you about it. Cheers. Thanks for coming on the show.
Cheers. Pleasure.
So yeah, this one is a organic, like it's a little grower. So if you look on the bottle, there's a little number right down the bottom of the label says RM on it. Do you see that RM?
Oh,
and
yeah.
It has a number. So R means Récollet Manipulant. Doesn't matter. It just means they grow their own grapes and they make their own wine. And they don't sell their grapes anywhere else. So it's like fully integrated, if you know what I mean. So this is kind of one of the niche grower champagnes that if you're a bit more in the champagne crowd.
That's a nice surprise for a Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah, we can't go for the big brands. Well, these guys are like all family owned and everything. So, but it's from Choisy, which is a little village, but it's one of the Grand Cru villages, so the top quality ones. And this is a total 100% Chardonnay.
Yummy.
So 2014 vintage, I think.
Oh, lovely.
The last time we spoke, I think I saw you just after you talked Tractor Ventures on a talk there. Mm. And one thing that was really interesting was we share a common like for category pirates and the book there. So how did you get onto that book and how influential has that been?
It's an interesting one because I probably call it category king versus category pirate because one's like popular and one's like evil. But the interesting story is I worked in media as a youth and then Diageo and a couple of places like that and always loved it. And then I made a silly decision or exciting decision, whichever, it was a turn in the road to do a PhD in audience measurement. And it was actually while with women going back to work once kids are born. So I did it when my kids were babies. And I loved it. I loved every second about it. And it was a perfect time because it was when the Facebook was just launching and it was when YouTube hadn't even sold to Google. And it was an amazing time for change in the media landscape. As a postdoc, I made some decisions to look at whether new metrics were valuable. Mm-hmm. And it became very apparent that they were really all over the place. And then about the same time the MRC standard came in and there was viewability vendors and there was always for me a question around, you know, is 2 seconds enough? And even then, trying to understand how they measure that. I mean, if they're facing inwards and measuring metadata, how is that possibly human measurement, which is outward facing? So long story short, I did 10 years as in the university in the end, and I sort of decided to leave because the problem was getting worse, not getting better, and there were really not many people that sort of understood the nature of it and, decided to start a business. Crazy.
Damn, okay. Oh, there you go. Yeah, look, I've been following some of your work as well, and I think it's really good in terms of getting people to think about, okay, so we're getting all this reach, but what is it doing? And I think you've covered this in topic, so I don't want to go over it too much, but I think there is a big difference between, you know, choosing media and then getting an impression or reach versus actually getting through to a human and affecting them on a deeper level that actually does something as opposed to, you know, these volume metrics that are going around. So I like, is that the sort of problem you're trying to solve with there, and that's a space you want to own with your business?
We were kind of talking about category king, and what I sort of became really aware of, I left the university to sort of trial this thing called gaze tracking, which not many people had heard of. And you know, I thought, what if I focused on humans and how they interact with Facebook, you know, YouTube, Twitter, blah, 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 rather than looking at the metadata that sits behind it. And there was a stark difference between how much time on screen versus how much attention someone's paying. And there were massive gaps. You know, so it's roll of the dice if you buy on viewability metrics that someone's even engaging or looking. And so I had all this data, and what changed it for me was I was introduced to this book, Play Bigger, and I realized, given my knowledge and given the data that we'd collected over the years, I could probably do something bigger with it. So, you know, we were already, I guess, category leaders and thought leaders in the space because we'd published and, you know, done lots of presenting and stuff like that. So, yeah, I read the book, did a short course on hypergrowth, and here we are.
Nice. And I think it's a really good story because, you know, when we're working and doing marketing for other people's businesses, like think back in the day or some of the work you did early in your career, versus when you actually go and do it yourself for your own business, what do you think are the biggest differences between those two sort of mindsets and, you know, the responsibility and the advice you'd be giving your older self?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was actually a marketer before I'd done my PhD, I didn't really understand. I mean, I learned a lot from the Ehrenberg Bass Institute in terms of mathematical norms. But what I have done in this business is really taken what I've learned from that and tried to apply it. What's interesting from the days when I was in institute versus now is that so much has changed in terms of the media landscape. A lot of those laws don't apply anymore. They're just broken. And some people haven't moved on, but, you know, I kind of am trying to understand what a nuanced version of brand growth looks like. So to be honest, I feel pretty proud that I listen to my university tenure and think about all the distinctive assets that we're putting out and how our brand is perceived against, you know, category entry points and all that sort of stuff. So, but as a younger marketer, I hadn't been trained. So I was just trained like everyone else on, what is it, Kotler and
AIDA, all that kind of stuff.
So, you know, you just kind of, you go, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed when I put out that marketing plan for that $10 billion business when I was 30, you know, whatever.
Well, but I find it interesting because there's some hard lessons that, you know, you have to learn. And I think you don't learn them until you have responsibility for some of the outcomes, like direct responsibility. You know, when it's somebody else's money, it's a different decision-making process than when you actually, it's your money and you get incentivized and you're like, oh, I did that thing that I used to do and it didn't do anything. That's a hard lesson. So what sort of were some of the hardest lessons you had to learn that perhaps looking back, you were like, okay, I would never do that again or never think like that. But now I think like this.
Oh, look, I feel like I can't really answer that because we're not a normal brand, right? Because we're in a category that's literally just born. So all bets are off. And, you know, growth is different now. Growth is about having a voice, being out in the marketplace, a lot more marketing on stage than marketing through media and stuff like that. So it's a very different experience. It's about penetration. It's about getting into certain markets and getting footholds and getting people in there. So we've got an entity in the UK, about to put one in the US, and, you know, putting a stamp in the space and then growing into it. So I don't know, that's a toughie because I just don't think it's the same. We don't look at any metrics that are typical, such as performance-based. We pretty much look at our pipeline and how that's growing. And also I'm really fussy about the products we're building and what the uptake of that is. But yeah, it's very different than, you know, doing a CPG, which I've done.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that because like I do a lot of SaaS work as well. And, you know, I spend probably 40% of my time with products, right? And then maybe another 40 in building distribution networks, which is weird to say when you're thinking about services, but like you're doing with some of the, you just announced a deal with some of the group.
So in Australia, we just achieved 100% penetration with APIs into the holding cos, but we do have APIs into other countries, but in Australia, it was all of them. So that might be.
Yeah, you know, no, it is. Yes, yes. I just read about it, I think last week or something. So yeah, I mean, that's great because then they can resell your product to all their clients if they want to, or tap into it as much as, so instead of getting one customer, you're getting like groups or hundreds of them.
Yeah, it is. But what's interesting about that is there's no norm for the pricing, right? So when you're building a category, how much do you charge for a ride in Uber? I guess it's kind of a bit like a car ride. So maybe there's some other data kind of equivalent, but it's tough because if I'm building a can of soft drink, I know what the variation would be with how much someone will pay. But what do you do for data that changes their entire media, the course of their media buys and trade? So, you know, we're learning, and we, because I'm fussy about rigor, we've really only started to commercialize product in the last 15 months, if I'm really honest. Before that, my goal was to understand whether it was valuable and that it had outcomes linked to it, and B, whether it was different, or was I just being annoying and cluttering up an ecosystem? But the answer was yes to both. It's valuable to outcomes and it's different to current metrics.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. You're kind of talking about pricing there. So you're hitting all the sort of other P's that I think maybe some marketers only exposed to, you know, the comms P, or, and within that, advertising, as opposed to, you know, everything else, they earn media. So I noticed, you know, you're doing a lot of speaking circuits, and speaking about that, like when you launched your business, you were like somewhat had a personal brand that was somewhat sort of established, and you're kind of leveraging that and building that, I can see.
I think that's what makes me lucky in a sense. I mean, lucky, but worked hard. But I mean, I'm an older entrepreneur, right? I'm not 20. So I already had done 10 years. I was offered a professor role at Adelaide, which I just do adjunct. I don't do it properly. I already had a profile. I'd written books. I'd already done speaker circuits before. So I sort of had a profile. And what happened was I was lucky enough to be funded quite significantly by a very, very, very large well-known CPG. And then that kind of gave me a bit of a testing bed. It was a lot of money. It was decent. And then the very next customer, it was a whole bunch of TV networks. So, you know, I jumped in like into the fire to get it to work. But I was lucky enough to be funded really well because of my profile. And that just changed everything. So when you've got money to do R&D, to test technology, to understand whether it all fits together, it's a very, very different spot to someone who's 22 and
has an idea.
If they get a $10,000 grant from the government, they're lucky.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that because like I've got this other person who's doing that sort of more PR, that they're experienced executives, already sort of have a profile, and it just makes everything so much easier. And like coming back to, you know, brand effects, I think sometimes that gets overlooked by some startups who are like just focus on product and, like you said, the technicalities of the product, and maybe gloss over some of these that you don't get big deals without some kind of brand that it's really hard to get.
So what's interesting for your listeners, you should actually read, you know, Play Bigger by the Play Bigger Group in Austin, because they have, you know, consulted to some of the biggest category leaders. Atlassian is an Australian one they told me about today. Actually, I was speaking to them today. You know, and the biggies, the ones that you think of, you know, the car sharing types and the streaming service types, and they'll say the same. They say that it starts with the brand, and then you kind of build a category around that, and then you backfill it with what they call this magic triangle, which is about getting the business right. Because if you're a service and you don't have scalable, like for us, we didn't have scalable technology, so we had to build all the architecture, and we also had to build automation into what we were doing, and then build product suites around it. Once you know that the products are going to work, it's kind of this perfect magic triangle. But you know, you start with product first and it's not solid, it'll fall over. If you start with product first and it is solid and you don't have a profile, you'd have to spend $1 trillion getting it marketed. So it's an interesting one. So I highly recommend it to read it because it really inspired
me. Okay, I'm
going to
play devil's advocate here though, and please enjoy the champagne like while I'm talking.
Oh, I'm going to.
Some people argue that category pirates, okay, the detractors are like, this is just positioning rebadged, you know what I mean? Like it's a new name for an old thing. What would be your response to that? How does it differ?
So they're very specific about that and the difference. So category kings are people who build a category, not move into a competitive space and own it. It's very different. So it's where there's been no one trodden before, where it's like, oh, this fridge it's always done this with food, but what if it could fly at the same time? Oh, there's a new category, fridges that can fly. Don't do that. But I'm just saying it's someone that says there's a need, there is not an existing ecosystem around it. You need to build it and you need to sort of fulfill it with product. That's what a category king is. Whereas most people use that interchangeably and wrongfully interchangeably with, we're going to jump into a category and we're going to take ownership of it. It's different.
I was talking about this to another innovation expert, and I really want to ask you this question because I know EBI goes on about categories, right? Product categories and categories. When you go and get an investment banker, crunch the numbers, you know, if you're going to market, they'll use an existing category and existing data sets to then, you know, formulate your TAM or SAM or the market opportunity, right? But do categories actually exist like that in the customer's minds, and how much can you blend outside of those orthodox categories is kind of, I argue, I mean, the categories are a construct that don't really exist except in our minds. You know, what do you think?
So what's funny about that is some people really get it. So classic is we're like right in the middle of the second round of funding, and there are some people that totally get that, but there are others that go, you know, what's your TAM and how does it relate to this? And you go, well, it's sort of not really sort of. And so that's actually a really tough one because we have a TAM, but it comes from three different bits. And then it just depends on the evolution of the ecosystem. So, you know, anyone that comes in and says, you know, we're a category king and we know the TAM, I think is pulling the leg.
Yeah, no, it's funny. You know, I completely agree. And I think, yeah, like that's the premise of the book is create your own category instead of playing within other people's categories, right? So it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, you take a bit from them and a bit from them and a bit from them because you are still fulfilling a need, right? You're still fixing something. So whatever was needing to be fixed exists, but it exists in a different way, and there are no competitors or very few competitors.
Yeah, it reminds me of,
and that's the
it reminds
difference.
Me of people who like go, oh, Tesla's a car company. You're like, well, actually, kind of, but not really. It's like calling Apple like an iPhone maker, you know, well, that's one of their products, but then, you know, they started somewhere, they created an ecosystem around this bigger sort of need for simplified technology that's easy to use, you know what I mean? Like that's kind of almost what they own. That looks nice, you know?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I'd call Tesla a category extension where they've moved from a mechanical process to a technology process. I mean, if you've read any of their or his books around how they build, it's quite, you know, they do software updates. What other cars do that? Like automatically from the cloud when you turn it on, right? So, but at the same time, it gets you from A to B. So, and it's not that different in that way. It has four wheels and it has a steering wheel. And okay, it's probably working towards autonomous, but it's still to me a slightly different nuance. Whereas what we're doing is we're saying it used to be done this way. Now we're going to build something with four wheels and it's a completely different. It's a completely different nuance. So,
and what about, it's cool to talk about these things and make plans about, hey, we're going to play in this category and blah, 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 and our product's going to be awesome. But like, you would know this for the last like 2 years of building this product out, like doing it and executing is actually really hard. Like there's a skill within that. I mean, have there been some hard lessons along the way or something, or some wisdom you can share with people listening that, you know, hey, we tried this, didn't work, and try and use this method because, you know, we failed at this?
What's interesting is we had a design-led process from day one. So two things, design-led meaning that you do a lot of work with customers to find out what is important to them to make it daily sticky use, for example, particularly for the recurring revenue piece. It solves a problem, it's sticky. But on top of that, I cannot underestimate enough the importance of rigor, particularly in measurement. I mean, maybe, you know, if you're building a new toothbrush category, a little bit different. But then we've been criticized as moving slow, but I think, and I see all their products failing, but I kind of go, rigor's been a really important lesson to us. So, you know, there's moments where I go, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, we got to get out there. And, you know, I've written the blueprint and others are coming in and trying to take the land grab. But when products fail, they come back to those that they know it works, even if it's, I mean, a classic example, one of the biggest customers of ours is OMG Global. And Chrissy Hansen, who is just the most amazing person in the world, talks about considered versus commercial. And she's all about making sure that it's right, not rushed. And that's a big, big business. And it's global. So she just was promoted yesterday, actually, but she was CSO global for OMG. So not a small player. So she was promoted to CEO Americas. But so I love that because, and we see that that's been of value. So the moments the stressful for me is when there are others that come in and take or leverage the category that you've built. A bit like, I don't know if you've seen Super Pumped, but there was a moment when Uber went, oh my God, we've built this category and we've built, but Lyft are coming in and undercutting us. So how do we manage that? So that's the sort of stuff that stresses me. So then I have this argument in my head, how are we going fast enough?
You're like, we need to grab enough land to build defensible, like first mover advantage, all that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, but I'm not convinced that that is the truth because, you know, Google was a classic example. They weren't first, but they were the best. And then they came in when they were ready and they absolutely smashed it. And they own the ecosystem. And that's kind of our goal that, you know, we're doing it properly. We're doing it once. And when we do, it'll work. And particularly when you're trying to move to a measurement that's, if it's roll of the dice that it works or not, no one's going to move across to something new. They're just going to stick to viewability and the reach products they've had forever. And it's interesting because I don't know if you know much about Moat, for example. So Jonah Goodhart was the founder of Moat. And I think he's probably got other founders with him, but he's a famous one. I've read stuff about that and it took them quite a while to convince people to trial it. And then once they realized what they were measuring was real, it's not attention, I might add, but it's still a metadata. It's an inward-facing metric that says whether your ad's loaded or not and for how long. I mean, that wasn't in the internet before. You know, he got massive traction.
Kind of important.
Yeah. So he got massive traction. And I look at those types of case studies from grown businesses and think that's kind of what I want to do. So I'm a massive sponge for podcasts, books, inspirational stories, all about transformation and change. Ooh. And
I've got some good ones for you, you know, then. Well, I was doing some research on a guest that I'm interviewing. Well, that I interviewed this morning. He's Patrick from ProfitWell. So it's a fintech thing. Subscription revenue is basically what they do, and they handle all the billing and operations, like financial side of the business. Anyway, I was talking to him and I was doing some research, and then he was on another podcast that Sam Parr has. It's a video thing. Sam Parr sold The Hustle to HubSpot. It was a digital publication about entrepreneurship kind of people. Anyway, and then he was interviewing this other person anyway, and their producer that produces their show started a podcast about how to take over the world or something like that. It's very Pinky in the Brain-esque, but he deep dives into the famous entrepreneurs like Walt Disney and reads all three of the best books about the person. I'll give it to you afterwards, but he reads three of the best books, biographies about that person, and then aggregates together and does like a Dan Carlin hardcore history style sort of like summary of the person and what they all went through, and there's fascinating stories.
Yeah, I reckon I've seen one like that from Tim Ferriss. I've seen that one because I think he sort of then puts together, you know, a factor analysis around what was successful. And but yeah, I mean, I'm a bit the same. So, you know, I've got all these books on the growth of Netflix and the growth of Uber and all of those types. You know, I'm particularly focused on the category generating ones, but it's tough because then you get all this inspiration and you go, right, this is where I'm going. And then you have a day where, you know, a
churns
customer
or something
doesn't pay for 300 days and you go,
why am I doing this?
What are we doing? I know that you get back.
Give me some more champagne. Where is it? Yeah. Well, speaking about that, for growth to really occur, hyper growth, right? You said it requires culture fit. And, you know, this growth mindset, this term gets thrown around. I mean, I'm a big believer because I've been in these companies and it's really powerful. But, you know, talking about, I know this is sort of not really marketing, it's maybe one of the people P's, but how have you sort of created and settled on fostering a really good, strong culture within the organization and the benefits that's had?
It's interesting because we're nearly 40 people.
Wow.
And I think this time last year, there might have been 7.
Wow.
So what's interesting about that, and not many people would choose to do this, but I worked with and are working with a recruiter to find what I'm calling our cultural baseline. Because right now we're all working 10 to 13 hour days and you need to, it'll settle because we're about to expand. So because, you know, when you're new, everyone does so much, but when you're growing, you get your swim lanes. But I worked with a company called CareerLink, and they're an international recruiter, and they literally headhunt for me. To me, that's super important, because if the group sort of understand where you're going and they really buy into it, but not in a fake way, but really. And the other thing is, I just launched a massive ESOP structure, so equity share option structure. And, you know, for Australian businesses,
let me guess, cake equity
took us.
Yeah, Jason.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's great, great.
But it took us 18 months to put it together, because we're not a typical startup, because we had a valuation already. So there's a lot. It's a lot less easy when you have a valuation. You've got to get around tax and all that sort of stuff. So it took me about 18 months to sort of pull it together, but we launched it last week. So, you know, if you've got a team that's well hired, you spend money on recruitment, you call them your cultural baseline, you reward them with equity that can grow, we're pretty fortunate. It's quite a passionate bunch.
And like on that thing, like talk about mindset, I mean, have you sort of read books on that, and how do you instill that sort of in that growth mindset, which is, you know, you mentioned it before, the importance of measuring and iterating and like being pretty brutal about whether things are working or not, right? And having that sort of honesty within the organization. That's sometimes a bit of a hard barrier if you've done the political side of things and then gone.
Yeah, look, I think interestingly, we're having an away day in a couple of weeks, and it's focusing on uncomfortable growth, because last week someone had this job and then this week we've adjusted it slightly to grow, and we only did another cultural day only, I think it was early in the new year. So you need to really celebrate the wins, because the amount of work when you actually put it on paper is off the charts. Like we often say, a week here is like 3 months in a normal business, maybe even longer. And so we have Gin Thursdays and we all talk about it, and it's like, oh my God, Father, you know, in 3 days, what has happened? So it's important to celebrate, but it's important to give them support. So we have a people person, and she's building out a thrive and revive process, so that if you are exhausted and you need some time out, what does that mean without guilt? And I try my hardest to treat them. They're our community. They're our people. They're growing this business with me. And eventually I get the value from that. So, you know, I need them, and I couldn't do it without them. And that's how I reward them.
Yeah, no, I love that. And so where do you see the business sort of going, like, and the industry changes? Like we touched on this at the beginning about very traditional media measurement thing. You have TARPS here and this over here, very non-standardized, and digital came in and went, hey, look at these metrics. And then, you know, where's the future? We're going to be in the metaverse, like looking at digital signage, or like watching Netflix shows with dynamic product placement insertion and stuff like that. How are you adapting? Where do you see the future?
So I can't tell you that. But I do have a plan. At the moment, the next couple of years looks like mass penetration for the attention data that we have, which will act as signals in both planning and trading for buy sell, kind of equivalent to a signal in the stock market, right? So that's what I see the immediate future. However, I've already thought through beyond where that needs to be. And the other thing that's interesting that I won't say, because we have competitors that do land grab and try. But then the other thing that's really interesting and important to us is our tech stack. I think we use, given how much data we collect, I think one of the AI guys said that we use about 20% capacity of its power. And so we have a particular interest in using, because our technology is massively deep. It's not like a trinket gaze collection. It's really deep models using really, I mean, our CTO is PhD. We've got a couple of others in here that have that kind of qualification in computer vision and automation and things like that. So our vision is actually to move out of the category and think about other problems in other businesses. And it just so happens that our CTO is FDA approved, TGA approved. So he's medically inclined. So not for now, but you know, when we're settled and the growth curve's not hurting my head like the champagne, then I think we're going to sort of talk about jumping into another category to see if this technology, because at the end of the day, attention economics is the science of understanding what distraction and the impact, the distraction and the impact on society, right? So it's not an ad thing. It's a community thing. We think that's where we'll go. But in terms of the immediate category, watch this space. Interview me in a couple of years.
Okay. Well, I've got the goods then. Before you blow up, hey. no, that's great. And like just coming back to this, what do you think? If you had to give some advice to growth or marketing people out there that are potentially listening. interesting. Like any sort of sage wisdom from your journey that you want to sort of provide them with right now?
So if we kind of take it back to the problem we're solving for, the money you spend on media tells you little about whether a human's viewed, right? So and that has implications on any system, model, budgeting process that relies on equitable impressions. So be really, really understand that share of voice, share of market. I was in Cannes only a few weeks ago in this beautiful weather, unlike here, with Peter Field and Orlando Wood. You know, we were talking about the relationship between share of voice, share of market, and it is no such thing anymore. And it's a lot to do with the fact that we started measuring inward, not outward. So we started measuring what machines are doing, not what humans are doing. So I think be really open-minded. If your brand's not growing, it's quite likely because of the media you're buying versus any other aspect. Creative, we find, has the least impact on how much attention is paid. It's about the media platform and the parameters within that. So I guess that would be my wisdom. Just be really clear that it's not like it used to be.
I was listening to this video of this guy, Mr. Beast. I don't know if you know him, this YouTuber guy. Very popular with the young kids, creates this crazy...
Oh, well,
he's one of the big ones on YouTube. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And he was giving advice to this podcaster guy about how to upload his podcast video episodes to YouTube and how exactly to do it and all the details of... And each medium is so different. Like, you know, people just go, hey, social media, but like YouTube is very different to like... Another thing.
Wow. Well, yeah. I'm proud of him because that's so we see that, and which is why a lot of the viewability based models, including attention models, don't work. Because how I look at it is each format, it's not even each platform, it's each format has a different recipe. And if you treat each one with the same recipe, then your models will become.
Which is what pretty much every person does. They go, hey, one piece of creative, let's just adapt it to 16,000 different pieces of, you know, ad units, whatever.
Yeah, but it's an interesting one because I agree with him. We see that in our own data that people think that, you know, putting a full page ad on here is the same as a full, I'm not page, I'm from News Corp. So a full screen ad here and a full screen ad here is the same, but it's not in terms of the amount of attention paid. So when you model your data against that, you're compounding error, basically. So yeah. I agree with him. It's a different recipe and you can't treat it like they're all the same.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And that's hard. That's hard. But once you know the pattern, once you know the recipes, you can work towards it and you can model.
And do you think like people choose too many channels and then they create so much complexity that they're just missing the shots across all these mediums? So they're just like focused to like one, two or three and just like really own it. Like for your business, it's a service tech business, which is very different, like you said, but like the personal brand laid on, you know, events, talking to the right people, probably do some outreach, like sales outreach, you know, direct sales meetings, that kind of thing. Very different media mix. You can't be, I notice you don't do display ads and things like that for your own business unless someone else is bidding higher.
Well, we don't because we, you know, I've, you know, South by Southwest, Adweek, New York, Adweek, Europe, you
Press.
Know,
yeah.
you name it, I'm there, press. So at the moment, our investment has been in people. So we will get there. And in fact, it's turning because our CPO started on Monday. She's already on my case for some budget. But at the moment, we just want to invest in the product. But I think the answer to that question is I'm probably not the best to really answer that question because I'm not a marketer. I'm a media person. But even from my old days, because I was responsible for many tens of millions of dollars in my 20s when I was head of marketing for a big brand. And I just even remember even then, fewer the better. Focus on what gets you the most and leave the long tail to others. But then, you know, what they won't tell you in Ehrenberg Bass 101 is that that's fine until, you know, your CMO says, yeah, but we want all these different programmatic websites and we want you to put this much against this platform and, you know, and this is what you've got to do. The reality versus the dream is different.
Hey, I've got to play devil's advocate again here because what I've noticed is like the bigger the company gets, the less they actually care about measurement to an extent. It's like it's more of a political thing. Like, hey, is that ad on a billboard? Have we seen a TV ad? They don't really care where it is. Like, what would you say to that versus like a small business? Like, I need return on all my budget because otherwise we're going to go under. You know what I mean? Like there's two sort of polar opposites.
Look, I think performance marketing has killed the radio star a bit. Look to Peter Field for that because he is an expert in that space. But I think big brands can afford not to worry so much. I mean, there's plenty of modeling around big brands have efficiencies of scale, but they also, if it's not quite as good as...
It's like halo effect, right?
Yeah. You know, so small brands can ill afford crap media plans, basically, quote that. And we even see that, you know, in our own data when we model our outcomes. But yeah, devil's advocate is they probably don't care. And a lot of the bigger brands are governed by procurement, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, procurement and auditing companies, you know, in my opinion, have a lot to answer for the lack of quality outcomes for brands because all they care about is the cheapest. But it's interesting because cost is not commensurate with performance at all. So when I was younger and worked for News Corp, if it was higher CPM, you would get more reach, and it just doesn't work that way. Hmm. And thanks to bidding and the programmatic ecosystem. So bidding has meant that there's no real baseline to bring cost and performance together. Auditors, all they care about is their cheapest CPMs, and they report against them, but then performance probably lacks. And each category is different as well. So I think when you're selling something off the shelf and you have multiple
competitors side by side,
it's probably, they're probably a bit more interested in what their media dollars do, but it's pretty hard when they're spending, I don't know, small $10 million here and $100 million on Super Bowl and this, that, and the other. Like, how do you even measure that?
Yeah. Hey, and speaking of that, like people that maybe don't have the experience throughout the whole supply vertical of, like, you know, start to finish, media planning, buying, creative, all that kind of thing, all the way to execution and measurement of where they actually did something. I find there's a lot of discussion on social media platforms of these people in the industry just cherry picking ideas from like EBI or this person or that person, really haven't read the papers to a certain extent, you know. Like, and I see that a lot with the EBI, right? Oh, you should just get physical availability. I'm like, yeah, well, how? Or should get mental availability? Yeah, that's actually really hard. How are you going to go and do that? Like, what things maybe from firms such as that have you found to be like less practically useful in application?
Well, it's also the flip side. A lot of people take some of their stuff out of context. So the one I hear all the time, in fairness, is that you should do mass targeting, and you know, and this concept of wastage is good, but you know, people take things like that out of context. They just talk about, you know, the need to do category targeting, not hyper targeting. But on the flip side, the one that I think you should listen to more than anything is Jenny Romaniuk's work on and mental availability. And, you know, we talk, so they haven't updated it because they're all about replication and extension and finding the same findings. But she's just done a recent piece for Khan herself, which I think is really important. And it also talks about the how to do it.
Yeah.
So I think her work is probably quite different to a lot of it, which is not really applicable, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean they're a university, right? So, you know, I often say universities have the least innovative products in the world.
Yeah.
You know, case in point, you know, that's why I left.
Anything with like institutionalized like political hierarchies, I find just kills innovation.
It's also about budget, you know, at the end of the day, to your point before, like if I go, right, let's throw money here, but kill that, that's my decision. You know, you're in an institution that's governed by vice chancellor that's five levels up. I mean, how do you even manage that?
Well, anyway, congrats for your business and your business success. And I thought, hey, what better to celebrate than with a nice bowl of champagne? So yeah, I really appreciate your time today as well, because, you know, I've seen some of your talks before and I think you speak really well, and it's really fun. And just a couple of quick fire questions to finish that I ask everybody.
I mean, I need to drink for this, so I'm a bit nervous.
Oh, no, that's fine. There's no wrong answer here. So this is easy. Books that, obviously, you've already mentioned the one by Category Pirates, Play Harder, yes, not Bigger.
Play Bigger, not Harder.
So what other books have maybe changed your thinking permanently for the better? It could be reading them right now or in the past that you'd recommend other people to read.
Masters of Scale. Then, you know, the Uber story and the Netflix story. Like I said, the one from the original, when the original CEO was around, his name's Mark Randolph, not the new CEO.
Yep.
So anything Reid Hoffman, anything. At the moment I'm reading about venture capital and private equity, so it's a bit
other John Doerr one or?
Oh, yeah, that's Measure What Matters. I've read that. Mm-mm. Yeah, no, I've got quite the library.
You're
have
so
an actual library here.
Wow.
I'm not techie. I've got 3 degrees and I learned nothing about business growth, just saying.
I know. So practical. Like I read What About 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. Have you read that one or not?
Oh yes, I have read that. Yes, I have. So they're all good too.
It's funny how you merge them in your head after reading them without thinking about it.
Yeah, you put me on the spot.
Because if someone asked me, I'm like, I don't know, but I've got the stack of them over there, some of which I haven't read.
I've got one at the moment that's after, not Bill Gates. Who's Apple? Gosh, my brain.
Tim Cook now or Steve Jobs?
After Jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a book about what happened to Apple after Steve Jobs. So I've got that one to read. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Oh, sounds good. Okay, great. What about favorite website resource that is kind of go to? It could be like a little saucy niche website that, you know.
Saucy?
Well, like professionally saucy, you know what I mean? Like a bit of a hidden one or not the popular other ones. Anything there that your go to kind of website?
I like Wark. I'm a massive fan of. They say Wark.
Wark?
But whatever. but I do, that's subscription though. I do like MI3 in Australia, which is not a website, but it's a news distributor. So Paul McIntyre is. So he's fantastic and he brings in some amazing podcasts and speakers to that. So that's probably my newsy one.
I know. I was one of them.
Locally. Oh, there you go. That's so funny.
I was talking to one of his reps today who's writing the story on something else. I can't talk about that.
So I think locally he's fantastic. Campaign is good.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's heaps. You only really need one, but those are great ones. I really like what Paul does because it's a bit like it dives a bit deeper and a bit more forensic than some other ones.
Right? He's not a content writer. He's a journalist it makes quite the difference. So he wants to get to the bottom of a question. He doesn't want to just, you know, regurgitate content. So that's why he's great to read.
Okay. What about a quote or a meme, a really funny really good quote or a really funny meme that makes you laugh every time because it's so true? Any sort of viral Reddit things that have been going around the office recently? Or
no, so you would not be able to play those. They would be expletives. Inappropriate.
Well, some people say like in marketing anyway, Market Tunis, like Tom Fishburn, he's like, he just sums up some of these situations. You know, Tom Fishburn, Market Tunis, like really well in the marketing industry. Is there anything? I've got some other sort of Instagram accounts that are like parody accounts.
So the only one that is probably, and it's in my book, and it's probably a bit longer than the story, but its actual end point is, I'm going to swear slightly, not badly. It's science, bitches. And basically they asked this, it was a few years ago now, and this crowd sort of says to this really, really distinguished professor of astrophysics or something crazy, you know, how do you even prove that it works? You know, how does the law of relativity work or something like that? And he says, you know, if you drive a car, it does this. If you do this, it does this. It's science, bitches. And so I try and use that all the time. You know, if you don't see an ad, it doesn't work, bitches.
It's like, duh. Well, that's fucking logic there. You know what I mean? Yeah. Don't even need science for that.
Exactly.
No, that's great. Okay. And what about over to you? We have mentioned your company, but just to iterate, you know, what your company does to anyone who might be listening that would be inside your target market.
Yeah, so we're Amplified Intelligence and we specialize in collecting human attention data, which then feeds products to reduce error in the current media measurement system. That's kind of what we do. It's actually a longer story than that. But audience data, but real human data that we use to improve the ecosystem.
That's great. Yeah, no, I've been hearing some good things. And it looks like you're on a bit of a growth spiral. So that's good. You must be doing something right?
Hopefully.
Okay. And what about if people are really interested in sort of what we're talking about today, want to like get in contact with you? Everyone has their preferred method. What's yours?
I'm a LinkedIn girl. It's my favorite platform. Okay. So just DM me on LinkedIn. We do have a website with Hello. We have a customer success team anyway. So if it's more than just a Hello and you need something, email Hello at Amplified. So, yeah.
Hey, well, thanks so much for coming on the show and enjoy the rest of the champagne. Maybe, you know, pass around the office and celebrate a quick win.
They've already asked me that. They've said, Karen, you're not a big drinker, so we'll have the rest. Thanks.
No, that's great. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it. And all the best for the future.
Pleasure.
So there you go, a deep dive into the world of Karen Nelson Field and categories. And that was a bit of a mix of a day in the life of a practicing marketer and also a delve into product categories and category creation. So if you want to listen to the other active practitioner episodes, go and listen to the one by Rabbit Daniels, Andrew Walker, Matthew Hammond, Ross Sargent, and Patrick Campbell. Join 14,000 others following me on LinkedIn, 370 on Twitter, 215 on YouTube. You can find some really interesting snackable highlight videos on there categorized by topic in the playlist function. You can also listen to trailers to another episode that you might want to listen to on the podcast, so you can get a really good overview before delving into that and spending the time doing so. Tell me what you liked and didn't like about it. Maybe have some suggestions. A great way to get involved is via the Hybrid Seat Reverse newsletter, where you send me a question each month instead of the other way around. Just go to hybridseat.substack.com to sign up. Follow and press the alert bell icon to receive notifications on your podcast listening app of choice right now. And that way you'll get alerted to the next time an episode drops. And yeah, this really helps spread the word. So give this podcast a review on Apple or Spotify or whatever else you're listening to. It really helps spread the word to the right people. But that's all for now, folks. Thanks for the support and thanks for listening.